This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
It's where to
sea, in the shadow of Steamboat.
Thank you. We wanted to start with this song because it really conveyed one of the most positive, there's so much positive that goes on with this movement. These are people that have been meeting in the square, in Court Square in Harrisonburg, in what we call the gazebo, since October 17th, 2011. We're coming up on our 6-month anniversary. Much of that time, we were there every day at 6 o'clock. We go every Tuesday. We have our general assemblies. And what we want to talk about today is it's really a primer about what brought us to the square, what we're about, what we're doing, how do we do it, and then invite you into a conversation. So I'll have to keep coming over here. What we found, you know, here's the situation, a bought democracy, extracted economy. You know, there's a lot going on in our world today. But what we want to present to you is Occupy, what you won't hear on the AM/FM radio. We want to bring you some resources, and we want to bring you some ideas and some concepts about what we've been thinking about. Here's a beautiful quote that I thought was perfect for this conference. I won't read it to you, but just take a second and read this from Arundhati Roy, great author, great resource for the Occupy movement. And I just love this last part. I love the whole quote. But this quote, that another world is not only possible, she's on her way on a quiet day. I can hear her breathing. So when you think about Occupy, just can you give me some of the images that you think of? I'm a filmmaker, so I always think in imagery. Just call out some of the images, whether they're your own images or what comes to mind sort of viscerally and immediately about Occupy, image-wise.
Tense. General Assembly. Mm-hmm. Mace.
Mm-hmm. People's microphone.
People's mic. And some of that imagery is what really, for me, brought me into the movement when I saw a film, which I will give you some resources on, a film called Consensus. Have you come across this film? About the General Assemblies in New York, in Zuccotti Park, and just very early in the movement, people's mic, the people responding, the people sort of speaking each other's words and then speaking them out without amplified sound. And when we speak each other's words at General Assembly, it forces us to listen. It forces us to really embody this word embodiment just keeps coming up again and again around the Occupy movement. But we have to stop. We have to listen. And it's not, quote, efficient. But that word efficient also keeps coming up again and again. And I want to know what is efficient in dealing with the world that we're in today. What has efficiency brought us? So some of the images that I like to think of in Occupy.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to Ode to Stalin and the Russian poet Osip Mandelstam, Art on the Edge of Audacity. Actually, I can just quickly give you, I'm in a PhD program at European Graduate School in Saas-Fee, Switzerland. And our Professor Judith Balso, beautiful sort of educator, brought to us last summer, before the Occupy movement, Osip Mandelstam, the Russian poet in the time of Stalin, who I was never familiar with. And Mandelstam, what he did was envision Stalin in the square, eyes shining free. And that, to me, is the depth of the Occupy movement, the depth of what we can do as philosophers and scholars and poets. What Balso was saying to us is that our job is not just to use these words in clever ways, but for our job is to truly envision a world where people like Stalin can be free with their eyes shining in the square, or people like the 1% can be free with their eyes shining, and how radical that is, and how that embodies just incredible amounts of love and creativity. So as I mentioned, we started on October 17th, 2011. The first day, there were about 120 people in the gazebo, all organized by social media, another former Center for Justice and Peacebuilding student, and I started a conversation on Facebook. We got the word out there, and many people showed up. And it's fun to look back at this with our occupiers, because a lot of these people, although they're not coming down every day, these are all members of our community that we see and still support us and are out there active in just so many ways. And again, my fellow occupiers, I just want to invite to step any time. What we are not a commodity. We are not something that you can look at and say, wow, this will look good on me, you know? It's not something, and this is what people do a lot of times, is say, you know that jazz hands things you do? I don't like that. That's going to lose you. That's going to lose you, your people. And I'm like, this is not a marketing campaign. We're not trying to gain or lose. People really want to try it on and make them look cool. That's not what we're doing. It's not a commodity. And people, it's so hard to get out of that commoditized mindset. Ruth, do you have a thought?
I'd like to say a couple of things. Personally, if you want to, during the slideshow, mm-hmm. And I think this might be a time for me to say, when I look at what we are not the church. And some of us come from, many of us in the group, though, come from a church place in making, really compelling us toward being part of Occupy. It's kind of curious, but for me, I want to treat you as a discernment group for 1 minute, because I want to say something to you that I haven't said to the Occupy group, but that I would say to family or church, and this is a place where I feel like it should be said or could be said. This is a place, Occupy, and my participation in it, I was very involved with the Declaration especially, where I come to the brink of a huge seduction of the American ideal. It's huge for me. I come from a family where there was a jail draft resister who went AWOL. That would be my great-grandfather from the Confederate Army. I come from a family where my grandfather went and argued before the Virginia Board of Education in Richmond against compulsory flag salutes of the children of the Mennonite Church. And he won. I come from a family where my mother was a war tax resister for years, and where she opposed a flag that stood in a church where she went to be a temporary pastor. So I find myself really surprised in this experience that I wanted to be involved. I was a poverty lawyer for a decade. I can see how people are hurting because of something that I think they need to understand better and do something about with the tools in front of them, which have to do with their own Declaration of Independence and the democracy that was created in this country to help people. And so when I drafted the Declaration, the words that meant the most to me were that people in this country threw off the tyranny of monarchy for democracy. Now we must throw off the tyranny of money to reclaim democracy. It's a modest goal, but an important goal. It's based on an understanding of the importance of this nation, which I value and don't hold as an ultimate identity for me, but which I believe is something useful and good to do for the people who I carry in my heart because I'm a follower of Jesus. So I'm trying to keep the right distance and the right sense of my ultimate loyalties, but I also feel that I've got to be there, and how can we not be there to help people reclaim democracy, because the distortion of money distorts everything. Everything good that anyone tries to do. All of the differences we have about specific issues in this country, the Tea Party people, the Occupy people, it doesn't matter what you think, because money will decide it. And unless we can help people get to the bottom of that, we can't go forward just as a nation within those parameters. So that's why I'm involved, but I need my church community to help me keep the perspective where my ultimate loyalty is, but also where is my ultimate nurturing and strength that allows me to do this as one of the things that I feel called to do. So thank you, and I appreciate you lots.
Thank you. When we go on to what we are, what we've talked about in our big time together, we are an articulation. We are an invitation. We're permission to be so audacious that you take your body down to a public square and sit there with perfect strangers. It's a little crazy to do that. And it is a process for becoming awake and therefore powerful, and realizing that those feelings that we have in our bodies, you know, I had that feeling for a very long time. So there's something wrong. And I can't speak it. I know there is. I can't speak what it is. And what it is permission to even just have that frustration and follow it down the rabbit hole. It's permission and articulation. Several people have described this space, especially people that come to the space from the outside. Occupy Harrisonburg, look how beautiful that is. A sacred physical space, ultimately, where we figure it out together. And that word sacred is, you know, there's also this re-enchantment of small, beautiful experiences, the re-enchantment of words that we've held away from us, worried that it will categorize us. Even the word occupy, I'm of Native American heritage, I'm reclaiming that word, occupy. I'm reclaiming the word sacred. It really is beginning to mean something to me. Brian wanted us to talk about, from the beginning, what I felt is I can't be some part of something that's just protest constantly. I really needed to see that there was an envisioning process and that we were pro something, not just anti something, and then that's our intention that drives us. That's our map. Pro people, pro local, pro peace. What we do. So this becomes then the steps that we take. And of course, Time called us the person of the year. So what we do, we first celebrate what works. Harrisonburg is an amazing place because there's a fantastic local food movement. People are of place. There is the Anabaptist DNA here, which I am not from a Mennonite tradition at all, and it's the Mennonite tradition of community, frugality, intention, the tools that are here in order not to deny that there is a world that is broken out there, but tools in order to heal that have been in place for a very long time. And that radicalism, people aren't afraid of the word radical. You know, people are not afraid of the word subversive. At this in this little community that I've ended up in, that to me, from where I come from mainstream media in Washington, D.C., I can't believe it. I can't believe it. So first we celebrate what works. There's so much here that works. There's a food co-op that hired 19 people in a down economy. There's the Little Grill. It's a worker-owned restaurant. Yay, sparkles, jazz hands. Jim, did you want to say something?
I wanted to say some radical things. I may be familiar to some in this community, but I, on my mother's side, I'm an Episcopalian, Church of England. In London, if you take a walk, Washington stand, Karl Marx told us that the wealthy of corporations would take over the world if we didn't stop them. And then you go the other way in London, and you're at our abbey downtown, where Sir Charles Darwin rests, who told us that we all change. A radical thought. I just wanted to say that the thing that attracts me to this movement most of all is its openness. We are not a boardroom, a smoke-filled room where decisions are made. It's open. We are not a star chamber. We, you know, anyone who wants to arrive and bring what they bring to this movement can. We are not a secret organization. We don't draw fish on the ground and erase it. We don't have secret handshakes and such like some societies. What I want to say, most of all, is that when you show up, all of us are organisms. You want to be a part of our organization, do something really organic, then feel free to show up at any time. 24 hours a day, we can occupy that space. It is public space. It's not private space. And so you, the public, are welcome anytime you want to come. And I just want to say that someone noticed, it's not something someone invented, or envisioned, someone noticed that the sea refuses no rivers, no matter how big and small, no matter how toxic or how pristine and pure, the sea allows all rivers to flow into it. I like the people to treat the gazebo down there as the sea and show up. And guess what? You don't get to bring your house. You know? I'm a practical guy. Yeah. You don't get to bring your car and all that stuff. You don't get to bring your land. We love yourself, every one of you. We love it when you all show.
And we have 2 minutes left, probably, so. So these are the steps that we take, so we're good. These are the things that we do. We occupy a sustainable living homestead. We find prophets and sages in our neighborhoods. We ask people to move their money and look at, you know, these are like goofy little pictures. Like, this is my mom's picture. Like, I took this picture, but, you know, it's given me permission to be like, oh, love that. We've protested Bank of America to move their money, to move people's money not only out of Bank of America, but Bank of America move your money out of mountaintop removal. That was a beautiful protest where we sang the whole time. Occupy Congress, we've been to D.C. twice. We're all learning together. We're reading David Graeber's book on debt, and you know, watching movies. We come together. We educate ourselves because the economy is elusive by design, and we're here to stop that. Student debt, the economy, teach. Here's our theology. A note on Anabaptists. That I feel that Anabaptists have, this is my little theory, that 1 minute, have done this really well, held themselves slightly away, create a community. When I move in 2 weeks, I don't have to pay for movers because I've had probably 10 people say to me, I'll come help you. Again, radical. From where I come from, where it's a justice issue for me to, you know, pay for everything, you know, because that means I'm successful. So rewired my brain completely. But I feel Anabaptists maybe have done this so well that there might not feel that emergency for the Occupy movement because they've really been successful in creating this community where they're frugal and they do these things. So maybe the emergency isn't quite there. Maybe that's why Occupy hasn't resonated completely. Lots of support. Lots and lots of support. So again, the situation.
Can I say one thing?
Yes, yes.
For me, it's been very important what happened in Latin America with liberation theology. And for years, I've been wondering what shape would liberation theology take within the United States. And I would say that the Occupy movement is the beginning of that. And the important thing in Occupy is learning from other countries. From Egypt, from Spain, that's where its origins are. in some respects, that Latin America is closer to us. But when you look at an occupation, that reminds me of a plantón in all the capitals in Latin America, where people sit down until they get justice in the civil square. And I guess the only thing I would say is one of the most important things to me is that is the method that liberation theology used, which saw theology as a second act that came after praxis, that came after active engagement in a struggle. And then out of that active engagement in the struggle, there was a theological reflection on that action. And I think that methodology is an important contribution that is helpful to us. We can learn from what others have done. This is basically a global movement that Americans are finally joining with the end of American exceptionalism, which also means the end of the American empire. So I think that's what this is all about. So I really encourage everybody to get engaged, and from within engagement, think about this movement. Not from the outside, because you can't see it from the outside.
Can't see it.
It's not a dead commodity, as Paulette is saying. It's subjects coming together to live like subjects need to live and ought to live.
And we'll wrap here. And yeah, thank you. Thanks. This is going to be a little bit to shift gears into maybe what may seem a little esoteric. I'm not sure. I'm not going to use the language of occupy, but I think that this, what I have to share, gets at some of the basic philosophy or our basic impulses at the heart of these issues. So with those comments, I'll start. I've been brimming with a revelation recently of how the communion between members of the Trinity is at the heart of the character of God, and how it's the essence of creation, and how it's the kind of relationships that we are created for. But as much as I love this revelation, I realize that it's required a complete re-education for me to truly know, because it's completely opposite to my natural inclination. The natural inclination of the world, of myself, of empire, is to build up oneself at the expense of another. We live in an environment of fear, thinking that we must continually defend our own interests. We are in combat, believing that we must either exploit or be exploited. Is that right? The selfish impulse of empire creates its own perverse trinity. So this is from Mike Breen, that this trinity is celebrity, consumption, and competition. Does that summarize our world today? Here we are gathered to resist the tide, to try and find embodied education. And I'm on that journey. I'm looking for education that does not mouth the value of humility, but then through its structure create the will to power. Looking for Christian leadership that is about service and not celebrity. And looking for Christian discipleship that truly transforms our desires. So as much as I love academic study, my re-education started ingloriously when I graduated from seminary. With all my desires for success, it was a rude awakening for me to find myself newly married in an average church, estranged from most of my friends, and unemployed. So the surprise for me was that as I entered the journey of losing myself, that failure was not the end. Instead, it opened up into a new place of life. And as I tried to create art, I found that it was only possible to create when I was willing to fail. This kind of self-emptying love, revealed in the nature of art and art making, which you can see in the back, is foundational to who God is. It's foundational to who we were created for in relationship, and foundational to the nature of our world. So this kind of love redirects vocation. This kind of love clarifies desire. This kind of love reforms our relationships. I'll tell you a little bit of my story. It started when I went into the studio with dreams of becoming an amazing artist.
I didn't want to waste my precious time or materials on things that were going to get trashed or sit in the basement. So I didn't play around, experiment, or practice. Everything I did needed to be efficient. It needed to be used for something. It needed to contribute to a progress. And as long as I had that mindset, I could not proceed. Because everything that I did, with every mark, I made a mistake. So finally, I got so frustrated that I just read a book on painting instead of actually practicing. I actually did this. And believe me, you can no more learn to paint by reading a book than you can learn to love by reading. I spent most of that year agonizing over misdirected projects, trying to correct costly mistakes in my real materials, and being really stressed out and unable to produce anything until there was a commission deadline that was like right on top of me. Really stressful. So my desire for productivity killed my ability to produce because I stopped practicing. And my desire for success was distracting me from the craft at which I wanted to succeed. Finally realized that making art is only possible when you're willing to fail. And this is what longtime Christian worker Keith Wasserman calls a theology of failure. It's actually what gives a vocation longevity. It's our vulnerability and willingness to take a risk that allows us to create something new and make something more. So if I'm willing to fail, I'm not doing whatever I'm doing to win the admiration of others, but for the love of doing it. The more concerned I became with the value of my work, the more contrived and miserly it became. When art became about my ego, the heart went out of it. So in that sense, art is made for its own sake. I must make art because I love to make art. That's the only way I'll want to spend time practicing my craft. That's the only way I'm going to keep going when accolades fail to materialize. The work itself is intrinsically valuable. And I think this is a valuable lesson for any vocation. But it's especially valuable for vocations that are not as apparently useful. See, doctors and teachers, and there are a lot of Mennonites who are doctors and teachers, they don't have to give themselves pep talks on their contribution to society. But artists, we have to grapple with this because we have to be convinced, in spite of everyone else, that our work is inherently valuable, even when most of it will never leave the basement. So this realization, if you're catching on to this, is a practical and, for me, painful application of Aristotelian virtue ethics, right? So while I've long had a bone to pick with the modern idea of autonomy of art, and that's another big thing, reframed in terms of intrinsic and extrinsic ends of virtue ethics, art should be autonomous. Because in this sense, the for its own sake of art is not pitted against its meaning or function, as it is so often in modern aesthetics, but against art being a means to an extrinsic end, such as fame or wealth, which, of course, are no strangers in the art world. So is art really about the visual expression of memory, of sensation, of exquisite texture, color, and composition, or does it only serve as a rung in my ladder of achievements? That's the commodity thing, right? How many times do we go to famous galleries, pass by rooms full of art, only to pause a few moments in front of that one Da Vinci piece, snap our trophy photo, right? How many? I've done it. Reframing art making via virtue ethics, art should be autonomous in the sense that its joys and successes are internal to its own coherent world of visual expression. So a quote encapsulated this realization. We either contemplate or we exploit. And that's from Alan Jones via Andy Crouch. It was a wake-up call that I could not go on exploiting my art for my own sake. I began to reorient myself to openness, to waste time listening, to valuing art for its own inherent joys and playful discovery. And true to virtue, a lesson learned in one craft has broader implications. What other areas, what other relationships had suffered from my hungry exploitation? Could it be that I approached my creator like a career services help desk? How many times had I drawn near not to contemplate, but for God to serve my ends? Just as good art and solid practice withheld itself until I was no longer grasping for the quick road to progress, So God sat with me, compassionate but tight-lipped, saying, serve me. Seek after me for my own sake, because I will not be manipulated into serving your future. You either contemplate or you exploit, and God will be worshipped, not exploited. It wasn't long before I realized that the same openness and vulnerability required in art, the same contemplation and listening stance required as I approached God, was also what I needed in my friendships as well. And this was the hardest learning curve, because if I can learn to receive from people who get under my skin, who I think are downright wrong, who may have obvious failings, then I'm truly on the path to knowing God's love. Because God's love is about humility and not about having the right knowledge. True community is in valuing others not for how they relate to me, but for who they are and how they contribute to my life in ways that I cannot control. So old habits die hard, and this re-education happened because of an enforced fallow time. In the fallow times, our addiction to productivity, to efficiency, to superiority is broken. The mystery is that in apparent stagnancy, there the gift of new life is revealed, not the success we expected, but a truer healing. We find ourselves thankfully reduced to seeking things for their own inherent beauty and value. The inherent beauty and value in art is that it reorients us to the intrinsic value of the created world. Art does this in several ways. The first way is that art is elusive. At its best, art cannot be reduced to a verbal explanation, one person's experience, one meaning. There's always more meaning. It's not that it doesn't have meaning or content, it's that there's always more content, more meaning than what the artist had originally intended. And this is what really irritates people about art, but this is also what's really good about art. Art is generative in the way that it opens up into associations. It's always full of metaphor, of symbol. It doesn't narrow down, it doesn't coerce into a take-home message, but it broadens out, it invites participatory dialogue. That's what makes art so powerful, so elusive. The other way that art opens our eyes to the intrinsic nature of the created world is in art's in-your-face, non-utilitarian stance. It's not that it doesn't have function. Art has function. It's that it has more than just functional. The piece of art is wasteful. It's pleasurable. It's superfluous. It's more than anyone's use or appreciation of it. It has a pleasure and a coherence all its own. The for its own sake of art is crucial in a world where everything has been co-opted into an industrial machine of consumption, where everything becomes an instrument for the appetite of something else. Art reminds us that things have their intrinsic worth. So where does this more than come from? And I'm drawing a lot from Rowan Williams' book, Grace and Necessity, Reflections on Art and Love. The artist does something very essential when they create art. The artist gives of themselves. They are vulnerable. They are willing to fail. In giving, they do something unique. There is a profound gift of freedom and release, a release of control in making the work. In that release, the work is permitted to have its own integrity, to be for its own sake. So artists create not out of their need, but out of abundance, out of non-necessity. So Rowan Williams says it this way, the artist gives a gift of themselves, they give of themselves, but they also give a gift of a self. It's this relational gift that reveals to us the intrinsic nature, the for its own sake of the world that God created, because this is exactly the kind of love in which God creates the world. The world is an untamed, non-utilitarian world where there is senseless waste, hidden beauty, and passionate abandon. The universe is not made for our use, or even for our pleasure, but exists because of God's generosity and freedom. In a far more profound way than any artist, God creates out of dispossession, out of non-necessity. God creates out of a place of overflowing, waste, gratuity, overabundance. It's not miserly. It's not cost-effective, not efficient, not bottom line. This freedom of things in the world beyond use, beyond sense, and certainly beyond what humans understand is what is described in Job 38-41. The poet describes the wild strength of the ostrich who lays her eggs and leaves them, laughing as she runs in the wind. Doesn't make sense. God's pleasure is in the animals who revel in their own power. God created the world for God's own pleasure, yes, but God's pleasure is in each thing rejoicing in being itself. God's self-giving impulse that generates more life, generates other, is the grain of the universe. It's the character of our inherently relational God. Each member of the Trinity gives of themselves to lift the other up. Christ risks it all. He empties himself so that the Father may be known and glorified. And in that creative act, our salvation is generated. The Father exalts Christ to the highest place. The Father glorifies the Son. The Son glorifies the Father. And then out of love, the Father and Son send the Spirit, who is called the giving gift, who lifts us up to worship and glorify God. And then the whole cycle repeats itself as we, through the Spirit, are empowered to give ourselves away for others to the glory of God. So the Trinity is three persons united in one common essence. Their trust in one another. Their desire to prefer each other's interests. Unfortunately, our world's empire impulse has radically twisted our perceptions of what it is to submit and what it is to glorify. To submit is to be exploited. To have someone give up themselves for you is to be manipulated and controlled by indebtedness. It's an awful weight. To be glorified or to have a self is to be given license to take advantage of others. So it's a choice of exploit or be exploited. No wonder we don't know how to love. But in God's love, our giving of ourselves for the other is a release of the other into their own selfhood. Instead of miserly, manipulative, or contractual reciprocity, you have the inherently freeing and expansive mutuality of companionship. So this is something that we can all identify with. I'm bringing it down to the micro level, I guess. We're all struggling with manipulative reciprocity. This is the life we live. But every time we open our eyes toward gift, we move toward mutuality. So I'll give you two personal examples. When I was first married, I was keen not to let my rights and identity be subsumed by my husband's. It was this idea of independence. But even as he assured me of my worth and integrity as a person, in my anxiety, I related to him with suspicion, with defensiveness, with resentment. So one day, years later, I woke up. I realized I didn't have to fight for myself. I trusted him to have my best interests in mind. And at that point, it didn't matter about submission because it didn't squelch me. I knew that he loved me as myself, not for how I related to him. I was healed of my anxieties through his love for me. So as I let go of myself, my only hope is that I can do the same for him. Let me prefer his interests. Let me submit. My second example, my friend Sarah, this is a different focus. My friend Sarah is what people call a needy person. She has self-esteem issues. She is naturally drawn to me as someone who can help her, and I to her because I'm someone who likes to help. I enjoy being needed, being esteemed. So I try to fix her with all my amazing advice, right? This is a recipe for codependency. This is not healthy. If I'm truly to help Sarah, the only way to help her is for me to need her, to be vulnerable myself, and to empower her with my esteem for her. It's the only way. The relationship is only life-giving in that we move toward mutuality. How can we nurture this mutual edification and receptivity toward each other in the church? I dream about seeing the church change from being a place of passive recipients of professional services toward being a body empowered in mutual discipleship relationships. Because relationships in the world are created for this life-generating dance of mutuality. This is what we are meant to embody. In friendship, in marriage, in church, with our natural environment, we exist not for utility, but for pleasure in the pleasure of God. We were made to contemplate, not exploit. Where does this start? I mean, chicken or egg, right? How do you, when real exploitation exists, where do you start? How do you learn to trust in an atmosphere of fear where there's real danger? That's an open question. But just as we learn to paint through practice, we are healed not through head knowledge, but through first receiving this kind of love. We are healed through love. And it's in the deep experience of God's more than enough, God's expansive generosity, something so beautifully revealed in art, that we can have the security to trust and to begin this journey of vulnerability with others.
I'd almost rather listen to Bethany again. I wish you had been my college art professor and not Dr. So-and-so, whose name I can't remember, who ruined art for me. I'm like an ENFJ that wants to be an artist now. But I have to talk about seminaries and empire and missional and theological formation. This is good stuff, too, hopefully. So I should start off by noting the combination of gratitude and awkwardness that I feel being here as a presenter. Gratitude, because I get to share about a topic that I actually do care very deeply about amongst a population of people who I feel incredibly indebted to. But also, as someone who has no historic or formal ties to any denomination or group that identifies with the Anabaptist tradition, there's more than a twinge of awkwardness on account of coming as something of an outsider, but who knows, maybe this outsiderness actually puts me in good company. Nevertheless, as I seek to articulate my understanding of the particular features of Anabaptism that have not only been personally significant, but upon which the whole of my argument rests, there remains the distinct possibility that this presentation will be a prolonged exercise of putting my foot in my mouth. If so, you are welcome for the opportunity that I bestow upon you to show yourself to be a gracious and forgiving people. I wish I had the time to say a bit more from an autobiographical perspective, but suffice it to say that if I had that time, what I would want you to know at the end of it about myself are these three things. One, I'm desperately in love with the church, not my idea of the church, but actually the church as she stands. There's many things about which I do not find myself standing in solidarity with Augustine on, but in his statement that the church is a horror and she is my mother, I do. Indebted as I am to fantastic professors in schools, I'm deeply passionate about theological education and reflection. And finally, it's both the intention of my life as well as my joy to spend the whole of the rest of my days not merely trying to bridge the gap between those two things, but to erase it completely. I should also mention that while I have benefited greatly from both contemporary as well as historic Anabaptist theology and theologians, it was actually the missiological perspective of Dr. Wilbert Schenck, whose classes I came into at Fuller as a graduate student, that most converted me to the Anabaptist tradition. If you are not familiar with Wilbert Schenck, get there. As I take up the topic of the role of theological education amid empire, hopefully the summary provides you with at least a little bit of a sense of where I'm coming from and why I might dare to suggest not only that we desperately need to re-envision the nature, purpose, and shape of theological education, specifically at the seminary level, but why I think Anabaptists ought to be leading the way for the rest of the Western Church. First, a brief kind of discussion on missional. Before I get to kind of the Anabaptist vision. Since everyone and their brother seems to mean something different when they use the phrase missional, I'll try to articulate as best I can and as concisely as I can what I mean when I use it. For me, there are three core tenets. In each case, they're things that I actually discovered from points outside of the Anabaptist tradition, only to discover that there was a much more coherent and deep way to understand them from within it. I would actually say to, I would now have and do say to my Protestant brothers and sisters, if you're actually looking to understand missional in a full-orbed way, just go look at the Anabaptist tradition. That's where they should go, in my opinion. I don't know if you react to that, how you react to that, because a few of my Mennonite friends seem to be really surprised when I say it like that, which in turn is surprising to me, but there it is. I find it fascinating that the vast majority of missional thinking and literature offered over the last 20 years or so has come from non-Anabaptist traditions and individuals. The reason I find this so fascinating is that the primary point of reference used for these ideas and perspectives emerges from a concern to articulate theological perspectives appropriate for the increasingly post-Christendom context in which we find ourselves. The question in my head, as you might suppose, is this: if in fact this missional conversation is predicated on exploring and articulating theology after Christendom, who better to look to than the one tradition whose very essence is predicated on an outright rejection of the assumptions and values of Christendom itself? That being said, I believe that there are three core tenets to missional theology. First, God is a missionary God. There is a fundamentally missional nature to the gospel, and that the church is a missionary community. I'll explore each facet briefly, noting what I take as the complicity of Christendom in obscuring its vision, and then move directly on to the implications I believe these perspectives hold for how we conceive of and practice theological education. Missio Dei is a term that's used to describe not only the idea that God has a mission, but that God is missionary. As David Bosch articulated in Transforming Mission is thereby seen as a movement from God to the world. The church is viewed as an instrument for that mission. There is church because there is mission, not vice versa. To participate in mission is to participate in the movement of God's love toward people, since God is a fountain of sending love. A theology of the Missio Dei finds its biblical moorings within the notion of God sending across and throughout the scriptural account. There is a sending of Adam and Eve into the world, a sending of Noah, a sending of Abraham, sending of the people of Israel. There is the sending of the prophets. And then climactically, at just the right time, God sends his son Jesus, who in turn sends his own very disciples into the world to continue his mission, even as he sends his Holy Spirit to accompany and empower them. All of this taken together compels us to see that God is both on mission in the world and, from a Trinitarian perspective, is missionary in his very character. This vision of the character and nature of God as missionary was something that got lost within the cultural milieu of Christendom, as it was widely held that in the original apostles, God had done all the sending he was going to do. From here, it's just a very short journey to losing a vision of God's own missionary nature. For how can we continue perceiving something is true about God's nature if its expression has been totally eclipsed? Anabaptists, however, in their conviction that Matthew 28:19-20 continue to stand as a call to all believers to go and make disciples of all nations, retained their vision of God as missionary. They were sent because he was sender. Because they understood God as having a missionary shape to his character, or more specifically in good Anabaptist fashion, because this character was made manifest in the fact that God was, in point of fact, on mission in the world, they sought, even if only implicitly, to cultivate a personal and corporate identity of participating in God's mission in the world. This fundamental aspect of early Anabaptist theology bore implications for how they understood both the gospel and the church. In Christendom, a basically static understanding of God led to a correspondingly static understanding of the gospel. David Bosch cites Gustav Warnock, who notes that we miss in the Reformation not only missionary action, but even the idea of missions in the sense in which we understand them today, because fundamental theological views hindered them from giving their activity and even their thoughts a missionary direction. Bosch goes on to note that the starting point of the Reformers' theology was not what people could or should do for the salvation of the world, but what God had done in Christ. By and large, the gospel was seen primarily as the possibility of a righteous status or condition before God. Not so for the Anabaptists. For them, the gospel was more like an invitation into a way of life than it was merely a status or condition before God. There was an inherently missional dimension to the way in which early Anabaptists understood the good news of Jesus. This is seen most clearly in their emphasis on discipleship. Tom Finger suggests that Anabaptists undertook discipleship neither to obtain justification nor simply to obey Jesus' teaching, but from an eschatological apprehension. They could attempt discipleship because God's new creation was already present. In this way, discipleship is simply the way of life under God's reign, which from the eschatological perspective of Anabaptists is understood as both present and coming. Those shaped by the assumptions of Christendom, bereft of a vision of God as missionary, could not help but interpret this emphasis as some sort of works righteousness, a way of earning or meriting one's salvation. My interpretation of early Anabaptist soteriology, however, compels me to conclude that far from understanding discipleship as a way to earn one's salvation, it was thought of as a participation in God's saving work, expressed on personal, social, global, and cosmic scales. The final core facet of missional theology, as I see it from a vision of the church, as I see it, is a vision of the church as missionary community. This seems logically and naturally to follow from the former two tenets. If God is a missionary God who invites us to receive the good news of an open invitation into a way of life that is both made possible and exemplified by Jesus, and this by the power of the Holy Spirit, then the church is that peculiar community that witnesses to, in its mission-oriented life together, this alternative reality. Or as John Howard Yoder has said, the political novelty that God brings into the world is a community of those who serve instead of ruling, who suffer instead of inflicting suffering, whose fellowship crosses social lines instead of reinforcing them. The new Christian community in which walls are broken down, not by human idealism or democratic legalism, but by the work of Christ, is not only a vehicle of the gospel or only a fruit of the gospel. It is the good news. It is not merely the agent of mission or the constituency of a mission agency. This is the mission. This is a quote that, I mean, for me, as someone coming from the outside, has done more to help me understand and appreciate the Anabaptist tradition than almost any other. Yoder's remark here is a potent reminder that the church is no mere collection of saved individuals, but the very body of Christ, enlivened by the Spirit to receive, embody, and proclaim the present and coming reality of God's kingdom. This is an ecclesial vision that the church of Christendom, as it lost its vision of the missional nature of God and God's good news, simply could not imagine, much less embody. This brief discussion of what I take to be the core tenets of the missional conversation or missional theology was necessary to frame what I wish to argue for in terms of theological education. One final clarification. The nature of my suggestions and what follows corresponds not only with the Anabaptist theological vision, but with the nature of the early Anabaptist movement as well. That is, that in the same way the Anabaptists questioned not just the theology of Christendom, but Christendom itself as a construct, so too do I suggest that the problems we face are not those simply of adaptations to current models, but the underlying assumptions upon which those models are constructed in the first place. Thus, I might suggest that the way in which we understand and practice theological education has more of a resonance with empire than we might recognize at first blush. What I seek to propose flows from the conviction that inasmuch as the missional vision of Anabaptism helps us in theological realms, when I say helps us, I mean helps the broader evangelical church community, it likewise contributes to re-envisioning of theological education that rejects the assumptions and characteristics of the Christendom framework around which contemporary models of theological education are often structured. Whether or not this is as true for Mennonite schools like EMU as it is for the Protestant institutions that I'm more familiar with is going to be up for you to judge. So if I get done reading and you're like, dude, none of that stuff is true at EMU, good on you. So on to seminaries and empire, the implications of this missional vision for theological education. While we have seen tremendous strides in terms of a return to missional understandings of God, the gospel, and the church, as people come to grips with the end of Christendom, if not the inherent problems it creates in the first place, we have yet to see commensurate advances and adjustments to our understanding of the nature, purpose, and shape of theological education itself. What we stand in need of is a movement of leaders who will take the insights of the missional vision of Anabaptism and appropriate them for the world and task of theological education. My own modest proposal for what this might entail will take shape around the three central tenets that I've already noted. Specifically, I suggest that we must understand the nature, purpose, and shape of theological education in light of the Missio Dei, in relation to the missional nature of the gospel, and in service to the church as a missionary community. This theological framework, indebted primarily to the Anabaptist tradition, supports what I refer to as a missional vision of theological formation that I will describe as praxeological, mobilizational, and spiritual. Moreover, as my language in that statement should already convey, it seeks to supplant the notion of a Christendom-shaped empire that Christian schools must compete with other professional institutions at the level of theological education, of individuals who will serve who will serve a religious system firmly embedded within culture, with a more fitting idea that their primary calling is actually to the holistic theological formation of missionary-oriented and ecclesially committed disciple leaders. Thank you for the language of discipleship and what you were sharing. So first, this issue of praxeological. To begin with, the theology of the Missio Dei helps us to recover both the priority of God's mission in the world as well as a vision for God as missionary in his own character. Each of these has implications for theological education, not merely in terms of curriculum, though that is definitely the case, but in terms of the medium of theological formation itself. The Missio Dei invites us to conceive of the nature of theological formation not primarily as preparation for mission and ministry, but as part of our participation in God's mission in the world. Said another way, in light of the Missio Dei, mission is to be seen as providing the context for theological formation to occur in the first place, not as some future thing that we aspire towards. There is most definitely a vital educational component to theological formation. I don't mean to minimize that. However, I contend that the educational component of formation is actually short-circuited when it's abstracted from an ingrained relationship to the practice of mission and ministry as the crucible in which Christian character and competency are to be formed. To be blunt, I might suggest that the passing on of Christian knowledge to those who lack the character and competency out of which it might be put to use is kind of like passing along car keys to someone who's clearly drunk. They might be able to use the tool, but if nothing horrible comes to pass, it's only going to be by grace. In light of the Missio Dei, the purpose of theological education is transfigured from a quest to produce theoretical experts to that of cultivating reflective practitioners. In the famous worlds of Karl Barth, there would be no theology if there were no ministry specifically committed to the witness of the word. It's not in a vacuum, but in relation to this ministry that there is posed for theology the central problem by which it is constituted a science among others. If we abstract its origin in the ministry of the community, all its problems are either irrelevant or they lose their theological character and may be relegated to the sphere of general or more particularly historical scholarship. I think we're in great danger of that exact thing happening across our systems of theological education. To simplify, from a missional perspective, there is really no point or intelligibility to theological education that doesn't have as its source, context, and aim the holistic formation of leaders whose theological reflection is grounded in their participation in the Missio Dei. What are the implications of a theology of the Missio Dei for programs of theological formation that are truly praxeological? Without time to explore the details of these things, I offer the following suggestions. Elongated programs that assume part-time involvement. A move toward faculty who can be accurately identified as missionary theologians, those who are themselves seasoned and mature reflective practitioners. Diversified learning environments where students have the opportunity not only to absorb requisite information, but to process this information in context of apprenticeship and immersion in mission and ministry. Greater attention to issues of contextualization and the creation of learning communities as a pedagogical context that more befits what I understand to be the nature of Christian formation. Flowing from this recovery of the Missio Dei is a renewed appreciation for the missional nature of the good news itself, over and against the Christendom-shaped notion that the gospel can basically be equated with one's static standing before God predicated on a confession of faith. An Anabaptist perspective helps us to receive the gospel as an invitation into a way of life, the journey of missionary discipleship under the reign and kingdom of God. whereas the former understanding of the gospel has perhaps played party to our seeing the nature of theological education as managerial, an attempt to create capable custodians and chaplains of an assumed religious system, here we begin to reimagine the nature of theological education as actually mobilizational. In relation to the missional nature of the gospel, the purpose of theological formation becomes training missionary leaders. Those who will be leaders whose concern and skill set revolve not around managing churches as part of a culture believed to be Christian, or even further around church growth, but around mobilizing the people of God for participation in God's mission in the world. This is not only to discount the centrality and importance of classic Christian study in the areas of church, history, Bible, theology, etc., but to make the point that these areas of reflection are supplemental. All our theologizing takes shape and finds meaning around the principal aim of equipping leaders capable of navigating ministerial terrain with a missionary perspective and skill set. As above, I need to limit myself to just a general naming of the characteristics that I think will shape programs of theological formation that take this view. For our processes of theological formation to be truly mobilizational, given to the training of missionary leaders, they'll have to become much more affordable, vastly more accessible and flexible, engineered toward the preparation of cultural pioneers and innovators, which is a whole other huge issue, because if you're not already aware of it, most of the rest of the world thinks that Anabaptists have nothing to contribute to an engagement within culture. And I've never, in my understanding of Anabaptism, I haven't found that to be the case. And every time I hear somebody say it, I get upset. And then focused on the cultivation of disciple makers and community mobilizers. Collectively, these marks of a mobilizational kind of theological formation shift the evaluative criteria for students from how much do you know about the Christian faith to how faithfully and effectively can you demonstrate the Christian faith, a posture that seems more in accord with the Anabaptist vision of the nature of Christian life and leadership. Finally, the vision of theological formation that I'm advocating takes shape not only in light of the Missio Dei or in relation to the missional nature of the gospel, but in service to the church, understood as a missionary community. Having lost its proper missiological shape, theological education within a Christendom framework actually made it possible to believe that separating one's intellectual development from one's spiritual maturity was a possibility. Effectually, in terms of a relationship to the church, theological education became the locus of Christian professionalization, generally leaving matters of spiritual formation to the church, or worse, the individual. Against this move, an understanding of the church as a missionary community invites us to reconsider the nature of theological formation as an indivisibly spiritual enterprise. From this perspective, if our systems of theological education don't help produce people who both love Jesus and live like Jesus, we should regard them not just as peripheral, but damnable, having lost their very coherence with the nature and aims of God, God's good news, and God's missionary people, the church. Church and seminary are not to be seen finally as two distinct institutions with different but related aims, but two expressions of one ecclesial reality, fully partnered in their commitment to witness to the reality of the kingdom. Based on this understanding, we can further suggest that the purpose of processes of theological formation for Christian leaders is actually to train kingdom citizens in service to the church as a missionary community. I use the phrase kingdom citizen to signify that the calling of our centers of theological formation is not to create spiritual elites or religious professionals, but to train and equip certain people, those whom local communities have themselves discerned by the Holy Spirit as set apart in some way to serve the community. I'll skip that part. As a result, theological specialists are not understood as mediators of divine authority, but rather as servants of a hermeneutical community whose theological wisdom is actually the inescapable starting point for every educational process. I'm going to skip right to my conclusion. For over the last 1,500 years, dominant expressions of Christian theology have been occupied by the presumptions and contours of Christendom as both a cultural and theological force. Anabaptist theology, I believe, offers a tremendous opportunity to help the Western Church recover from this malady. This should take place, however, I suggest, not just at the level of theological discourse, but actually, perhaps more importantly, at the level of theological training and ministry. And herein lies the specific strategic opportunity before the broader Anabaptist community to envision and pioneer models of theological formation that seek not to advance its agenda on terms of empire, as dominant expressions of theological education have done, but by embodying an alternative reality altogether. Instead of attempting to exert power via knowledge through the primarily philosophical and theoretical education of students, a missional vision of theological formation will subvert empire by training reflective practitioners who, rather than posturing themselves based on their expert learning, simply submit themselves to a humble participation in the Missio Dei. Instead of attempting to exert power via cultural control through the creation of religious managers, a missional vision of theological formation will subvert empire by training missionary leaders who, far from being reliant on a Christendom framework in which the church and Christian faith exist powerfully at the center of society, they actually gladly receive the good news of God's invitation to engage the world from the margins. Instead of attempting to exert power via privilege through the production of Christian professionals, a missional vision of theological formation will subvert empire by training kingdom citizens who, instead of engaging in a quest to compete for the advance of Christianity on the world's terms, surrender the outcomes of history to God as they entrust themselves faithfully serving the church as God's missionary community. Christendom is a hard habit to break. This is perhaps even more true when it comes to institutional realities such as seminaries than it is for theological visions alone. However, if the theology that is emerging in post-Christendom, which owes so much to the Anabaptist tradition, is to be appropriated for how we understand the nature, purpose, and shape of theological formation, perhaps it'll be that the same tradition that offers to the wider church the most radical and daring frameworks for experiments of such an important task. Thanks.